Donc,
Merci.
from Oriental Art, with a researcher from Lyon slash Lille. And just going to let you present yourself in more details. Thank you for being here.
So I'm a maître de conférence in Lyon, in the Lyris lab, which is one of the main computer science labs in Lyon. I'm going to talk again about it at the end of the presentation because we are hiring this year. And so if you're at there, postdoc, or looking for professor positions, you may want to chat with me at the end. And I'm currently doing a sabbatical at INRIA Lille. And so that way, between cities at the moment. In Lyon, I work on plenty of different topics. I work on visualization a lot with Romain Dumont, and I also work on the technology and enhanced learning with Elisa Bouet and André Sana, and formerly Christine Michel. And over the past years, I've also started to work on questions related to sustainable informatics. And that was for, let's say, the past 10 years, something I was doing as a kind of side projects, or there was a touch of it in other projects that I was working on. And so maybe something we can discuss at the end as well is, I show plenty of projects and we can discuss some of them in more depth, but also what we can discuss and maybe more related to the theme of the day, which is also questioning what we do later, our work practices and all of that. We can also maybe discuss how do we kind of redirect some of our research practices or our work activities to be more aligned with some of the worries or questions that we have. So the work I'm going to present today is something that's really collective. I rarely work alone. I never work alone. And so these are just a few of the people I collaborated with, and basically the work I'm going to present later is based on all these collaborations. I've put four pictures. These are the people I'm working with currently most, the most. Nolwenn Modet, who is a design maître de conférence in Strasbourg. Thomas Thibault, who's the co-founder of SCOP, so a cooperative design agency called Praticable. Léa Mosesso, who was just finishing her master's thesis and will be actually defending next week at STRAT, so a design school in Lyon, focusing on design strategy in the Anthropocene. And Eddie Ranano, who just started her PhD on software obsolescence and, let's say, smartphone obsolescence. These are plenty of senior collaborators and plenty of younger master or PhD students who might present the work. So as is often due with these presentations, I start with some kind of big numbers. I won't go into the IPCC reports and saying that we're not heading in the right direction at the moment. But before delving into sustainability and informatics, I think it's also good to remember that informatics is only a small chunk of all the emissions we have, all the impact we have on the world. And so if we look at basically greenhouse gas emissions, a lot is actually coming from energy production. And so it's a fossil fuel energy production that's used for industry, for transport, when you take your car, you buy stuff that's moved from one place to the other, for heating our buildings. And so that's a large chunk of the emissions today. Agriculture and other forms of land use are also a good chunk of the emissions, and then industry and energy. So I just want to say, I'm going to talk mostly about informatics and the impact of IT and computers in general today. But there are plenty of other sources of information. If we look a bit more precisely into IT, so information and communication technology, that's often used in the English language, there are plenty of estimates. It's really hard to actually evaluate the the global world impact of IT on greenhouse gas emissions. But basically, it's one of the most recent and serious work that was published in Patterns last year estimates it between 2.1 and 3.9. And they do that by synthesizing former papers that worked on the topic and trying to correct what was published before based on new knowledge. And basically, compared to previous work, they estimate that previous work is underestimating the impact of AC. Since there are plenty of people from HCI here and also working on PhD topics, I want to outline that a lot of the researchers on this paper are actually coming from Lancaster and from the UBCOMP HCI lab. So you may know Adrian Friday and Kelly Widdix. They publish at CHI or UBCOMP every year. And just to say that the shift is actually quite easy if you want to work on these topics, there is a welcoming community and open ears there. And then there is a Berners-Lee, that's another one who's working on actually assessing as a specialist of this type of statistics. If we try to split within ICT, what does it mean in practice? Basically, there are three. So I stole this illustration from Gautier Roussil, and it's based on the paper I just mentioned. There are three areas of the impact or consumption in ICT. You will have data centers, and so most of the people who are working on efficiency today and grid computing are working rather in this area. There is an impact from communication networks, from the infrastructure to actually just data moving from one place to the other, and finally end user devices. And basically there are controversies about the shares and whether it should be like this or split in another way. In this paper, they basically argue that it's more or less a one third for each, like 31 for one, 35 for the other, but basically it's split equally between the three areas. These are the first impact of ICT, and then there are many more impacts. If you consider that we are digitalizing society, then basically you have like second order impact. The more you put computers in some places, or the more society is becoming digital, basically the area is growing. And unlike other domains, like for instance for transit or for energy production, we are aware and there are actually trajectories to reduce some of this impact. When we look at the projections for IT, we see that it's basically projected to grow in the 5, 10, 20 years. And we are not heading in the right direction. Basically, and all the gains that we could have been done by efficiency are completely deleted by the increase of the IT sector on society at large. If we look more precisely at devices, so maybe one thing to add here is that a lot of this data is really hard to get. So people who are working on these kind of estimates are actually fighting with a lot of industry because that's where the data is. It's not very transparent. It's really hard to get this data. And basically, you make a lot of guesses at different stages of the process. And at some point, you have to trust either IT companies, telecommunication companies, or manufacturers. And it's really hard to know what's behind the data in main ways. So here, I've taken the Apple Environmental Report Progress Report to just give you an idea of what basically you're buying devices, where it's coming from if you're buying an Apple device. So you see that a lot is coming from product manufacturing for our everyday devices compared to product use here, which is about 20% of the impact of a device. So what that means here, and I'll come back to that later in the talk, is that if you make super efficient stuff on hardware that you have today, basically you can improve things here. But if you really want to have an impact, it's much more important to have devices that last longer. And right now, depending on if you're talking about smartphones, tablets, or laptops, or desktop computers, you have different lifetimes, lifespans. But basically, if you want to reduce the impact, the takeaway message right now is keep your device longer, maintain it, keep it, fix it, try to buy some with longer warranties so that you can keep the device And if you see here, you can also see that there is actually a good chunk, which is actually also allocated to transport, which we sometimes forget. These devices travel all over the world multiple times. And so these are basically the impact. So typically, we focus mostly on greenhouse gas emissions and basically CO2 emissions, and we're worried about global warming. But that's only part of the story. So if you look there are many more impacts for IT than just greenhouse gas emissions. There is energy consumption that we're also aware of, but there is also material consumption. So that's the Mendeleev table, and that's the one for basically these are all the elements that you will find on a smartphone. And if you look at these labels, basically in the greenish, that's the material that is kind of there is enough on Earth. We know that for the next 100 years, it's going to be fine. We'll be able to dig some out of Earth. For the yellow ones, it's kind of limited, and in the future we won't find them. And then red and oranges are somewhere basically we'll have real problems to find and locate them in the future. And you also have dark red for the ones where that are coming from conflict zones. And so basically this to say that basically material consumption is important. Our devices are coming a lot, like all the atoms in our devices were digged from dug from somewhere and then put together and refined and everything. And this has an impact. It has an impact in basically pollution, work conditions, because it's typically done in terrible work conditions. And it also has like a lot of water consumption is also involved in the process from mining to actually producing chips and that kind of things. But it also has a lot of geopolitical implications. And forgot one in French. Basically, this relates to if we shift from having a purely ecological perspective to having a more, let's say, geopolitical perspective, IT is going to be impacted by a lot of the geopolitical tensions. So we've started to feel heat challenges with the war in Ukraine. There are actually mounting tensions between, let's say, North America and the US and China. Europe is also part of these tensions related to chip manufacturing. It's going to be the same for batteries, from sourcing materials to actually manufacturing them as well. And so what I want to say is that the challenges that we have to face when looking at the ecological crisis, we also have to take them into broader accounts. And also, if you want to convince people, it may like, ecology is an important thing, but there are also, let's say, strategic sovereignty issues at play. And if you want to maintain a certain use of digital technologies, we have to take them into account. And I would say that as IT researchers, we are kind of ignoring these things or thinking that it's dedicated to the geopolitical department of the university or, let's say, political scientists or maybe some other places, but actually it's going to impact the way we are doing research. The basic hypothesis we have about the way we are doing our research are going to be challenged in the future. And these are really strong things. I mean, the tensions around Taiwan at the moment are really strong. It could lead to really like a blockade of a chip traveling around the world. And if that happens, then we don't have anything readily available in Europe, since we don't manufacture the, you have in Grenoble chip manufacturers, but they typically don't build the ones for our computers and smartphones. So basically that's an important point to take into account. And my message here is don't think of ecology as one thing. So now I'm going to shift a bit more. So that was a lengthy introduction. I'm going to shift to more practical projects that I've worked on and maybe more HCI-related. So I say that just to introduce that a lot of the work on green IT has been done by people who are more interested in efficiency. And basically a lot of the research, for instance, at ICT4S and in other in grid computing conferences, and that's also visible in, for instance, the participation in the EcoDoc EcoInfo community in France. A lot of people are coming from grid computing and basically people who were working on efficiency. And what we realized is that when we improve efficiency, we have rebound effects. And so you're happy, you improve by 50% the efficiency of your program. And what happens? Well, you run twice as much or three times as much programs on your grid, and you need to expand your grid. And well, you've not really solved the problem. You do more with maybe with less, but the overall impact is actually bigger. And we see at the moment a lot of discussions on looking at use. And basically, that's the other side of the thing. If you shift, you can look at, okay, how are we going to reduce the overall usage of IT and maybe use less demanding applications and services? And that's where HCI has a lot of things to do. In, let's say, a lot of HCI has been actually geared toward looking around and seeing some cool technologies and actually saying, that looks super fun. How can we apply it? I'm caricaturing, but that's actually when you go to CHI, you have this kind of feeling of, okay, what's the next tech gadget and what can we do with it? And CHI, or the CHI community, HCI community, has been working quite a bit on bringing, making the, let's say, IT development and innovation reach larger masses, and basically fastening the adoption of technology. And maybe now is a good time to actually flip this thing and think about, okay, what is the way we can actually reduce or redesign or reframe how we are going to use technology? That's not only the work of researchers or designers. There are broader economical question at play. You have big players, and that all have an impact. But as researchers, especially those of us working in public universities, that's maybe also where we can have an impact. So today I'm going to talk about three topics, and to give maybe some idea or directions. I don't have any definitive answers, and so we can have a long, lengthy chat today after the presentation on coffee about, yeah, what can we do? I'm going to tell you about three things I've been working with all the colleagues I mentioned. The first one is on documenting breakdowns. Here we have the hypothesis with in IT that everything works, and or that we develop our research prototype in the lab and then we deploy it, and some industrial partner or Apple or Facebook are going to basically make a version that works well. In practice, when you look at how people are using technology today, it's full of breakdowns all over the place. And actually learning why it breaks and how it breaks can teach us how we could redesign things in a way that's maybe more sober, more sustainable. And then I'm going to tell you about some work on making things more resilient and extending the lifetime of devices. And finally, discuss more basically research approaches and methods, and so be a bit more effective about the way we conduct our research. As I was saying, when it comes to IT, we have the imagination or the thing we imagine of IT is that things will be seamless, fluid, and that it's going to work in different circumstances, that we're going to be able to move from one device to the other, that everything is going to be at hand, readily available. But whenever you look around, you see that IT is broken and that things don't work. The old joke of HCI researchers is that it's 2020 and we still can connect to our printer, but that works for plenty of other situations. And actually documenting those precisely tells us about ways we could redesign things. So I'm going to tell you about observations we did in high schools, some we did in outdoors, and the way people guide themselves using mobility apps and transit apps. And a more recent study we did on how people are using, are connecting to the internet more broadly. We conducted, you know, in France, there were the plant tablets a while back, and we decided that it was a great idea to give tablets to schools, and then people would be connected and that they would learn better and that everything would be nice. I'm caricaturing, but you get a bit of the idea. And then there are plenty of studies on adoptions of technology. So then looking at in high schools or how teachers or learners are adopting technology and basically becoming more fluent with digital technology. And when we looked at the literature, we found very little about the everyday problems that people have. That's like when a classroom is trying to connect to Wi-Fi, when half of the students forgot the password to log in the system when you want to start a pedagogical activity in high school. And so we conducted an interview study with plenty of high school teachers, asking them, okay, how do you plan a pedagogical activity that's going to involve some digital things? And digital things here is not some fancy thing. It can be just connect to the projector and you show slides in high school. It can be that at some point there are going to be two tablets shared by the classroom. So very minimal stuff that the real thing that's done today, not some fancy futuristic thing or what you pitch in a research project, just the boring mundane IT activities of schools today. And we found basically 1,000 problems that they have. So some related to managing the classroom, to basically orchestrating how to manage the attention of everybody, how to deal with Wi-Fi when a whole class is connecting to a Wi-Fi hotspot and becomes saturated, how to start an activity when basically everybody's coming back to the landing page and not to the page of today's lesson. And when you have like 12-year-old students or learners, it's kind of tricky to bring them back and all of this. And when we did that, we discovered that a lot of this is kind of too boring and not managed today or handled today by most digital tools. And I'll come back to some of the solutions we proposed for this right now. But basically, just to say, basically, when you look at the challenges related to adoption, you see that a lot is not some kind of tool problem, but more the mundane brokenness of it. We did something a bit similar in another project where we looked at wayfinding in transit. So basically, if you know CityMapper or Google Maps and you want to take a bus and metro, and we studied how people find their way in cities, mostly in Lyon and Paris. And our research project was really on helping people and visualizing journeys so that people could better travel in cities using public transport. But when we did studies also to figure out how they were doing it, we basically had a screen recording on a smartphone. Then we gave cheap cameras with cheap glasses with a camera here to have a first point of view a recording, and we asked people to go from one point to the other, and we analyzed what happened. And we're really interested in basically a more navigational things in cities. And what we realized is that the smartphone of people were also broken. So basically, people have a broken GPS. So with Quentin, we were with a friend yesterday at the train station. His smartphone didn't have a working GPS. So Quentin had to look because he couldn't, and that kind of thing. That happens a lot. People turn off the GPS because they want to save on battery and they don't want to do that. They have battery problems. The compass is not working, or if you're actually in the subway, the compass is completely disoriented because of the heavy metal mass of the subway. When you're coming out of the subway, you have a time to GPS fix. So basically, when you're looking at the map and the application, well, the GPS, you didn't get a GPS fix, especially if you have a phone that's not super fast. And so basically, you're looking at a phone. When you were looking at the Google keynote explaining how the new Google Maps is going to work, that never happens. But in practice, it happens all the time. Sometimes people even turn off 4G. And so basically, they want to have an offline version and that kind of thing. So they take screenshots of their journeys and then just look at the screenshot instead of looking at the at the end. So again, that was really not the focus of the study at the beginning, but it was filled of that kind of experience of working with and living with broken devices. And so basically, I come back to that again, we propose some redesign. But what I want to emphasize is that broken devices are everywhere. We don't live in a bright future, we live in a broken one. And there are plenty of opportunities for redesign that can help people and be more sober in many ways. The last one we did was actually we interviewed students, especially students in dormitories, about the way they were managing connectivity. Our hypothesis is that in student dorms, people would have challenges in basically everybody would connect to Netflix at the same time or at the Zoom lecture at the same time, and that they would need to basically negotiate the way they are managing their connections. And that was basically how we started the study. And what we discovered was also plenty of problems. Here we really looked for the problems because we had seen all of this before, and so we looked at this. And what we noticed is that there was an increasing shift from Wi-Fi connectivity to 4G, especially for students, bachelor and master students, and especially in this kind of a shared dorm or environments. And also that when they were facing problems, especially the ones related to connectivity and networking, there was really very little help for troubleshooting. So when we conducted the interviews, we had a lot of folk theories of people opening door windows, trying to infer how the waves of Wi-Fi were traveling in buildings. And I won't go into too many details. We'll be presenting that work at IHM, hopefully in a few months. So you will have all the details there. But there were plenty of problems, and basically it's really hard to troubleshoot broken networking issues. And there are plenty of tools for experts, but when it comes to lay people, there is really. And also that happens all the time. All the students we interviewed had issues. So what are the takeaways from this first part? Our digital experiences are fragile. They break all the time. People don't have the smartest smartphone. Although if you, I won't go into this here, but when you look at how apps are designed today, most of the people working in design studios or development studios have the latest devices and test on the latest devices. So you have a complete discrepancy between the people who are creating the or designing the experiences, what they imagine would be experienced, and how it's experienced in practice. Even if you have a device that technically could work, it's rarely working at its full potential. There are plenty of stolen bugs and everything that make it work. And coming back to high schools, we also see that digital infrastructure will require a lot of maintenance. That was the same in dorms and other places. And if you don't have people who are actually taking care of this, it's not going to happen, and things are going to be even more broken. The problem is that all of this is kind of being ignored. And when we're interacting with each other, that's what we've seen in the student study. Actually, there is social pressure to have working devices, like excellent connectivity all the time. And so basically we build a world in which the expectations we have about each other are not matched by our own devices, our own experience. And basically we have a complete kind of discrepancy here. We didn't study that more at the moment, but that's something to study. But why are we expecting others to have better, more working things than actually the ones we have and still have? The second takeaway, and the one I started to hint at already, is that rather than thinking about sobriété, so we've heard over the past months a lot of calls for sobriété, sobriety, and basically self-imposing limits to our consumption, there is a space for positive redesign that starts from actually the experience we have every day with all of our things that are broken, and actually redirecting them toward more sustainable futures or directions. And that's something we'll have to do efforts. We probably won't be able to live in the world we're living today. But there are plenty of things where we can actually provide convincing alternatives that are actually more pleasant to use than the one we have. And here, that's some work that can be done in HCI, the HCI community. Checking the time. So now I'm going to present more like concrete stuff of what we can build, what we can do. Based on this kind of lists. And here I'm going to browse a few projects related to basically resilience and extending battery life around different directions. So one thing that's quite old, I presented this 10 years ago, the last time I was here. So, we're getting older. So back during a postdoc, we worked on a mini grid. So instead of building a grid with like fancy new server blades and that kind of thing, we worked on a grid that was for biologists and that would use the computers that were already in the lab. And so we built this infrastructure, and then we designed some kind of public display information to show what were the devices that were active or not, and attaching them to specific people. And basically, when we introduced these public devices, we noticed that people started also to kind of wanting to increase the capacity of the grid, and started to plug in all the old computers and desktops that were staying there in some corner of the office, or the ones from the library that were kind of old and never used. And basically, that gave a second life to all of these devices that were just in one corner full of dust. And so basically, there are some opportunities and things to think about and design around all devices and how we can put them to use if that can fit. It's not going to avoid that you're building a new grid somewhere for biologists, but if it can actually offload some part of the grid and you have something that's local that's also shared by the community, it can be also an interesting alternative. I mentioned schools earlier. So with Valentin Lachan, a PhD student, we worked on Toccata, basically an infrastructure for conducting pedagogical activities in classrooms. And when we built our platforms, we had this idea of resilience and basically network breakdowns completely embedded in the application. Basically, the application connects to the web. If there is no connectivity to the outside, for instance, because you have a DSL connection for the whole high school, and basically when two classes are connected together and watching videos, well, the pipe is too small, so it breaks. So in this situation, then it shifts to a more local area network, and basically the school is still connected, so you can still perform pedagogical activities within the students who are in the classroom. And if that breaks as well, for one reason or the other, everything is offline, and so basically you can still run the activity on your tablet. And we did that with web technologies so that it could work with kind of old smartphones, regardless of the versions that you have. Related to the wayfinding challenges that I presented earlier, we proposed and designed a new basically principles for guidance that work with as a kind of that works offline, that works without sensors, that gives more feedback about the sensors that are active or not, the ones that are working or not, and that's much more sober in terms of use. So that could work on older phones and without all the things activated all the time. This concept, we didn't publish on this, but this concept has been integrated partly by a company called CityWay, which is building a lot of apps for cities in France and in the world. For instance, that's the company that's building the mobile app for Toronto for the guidance. Finally, another thing that we're looking at and that we are studying at the moment, and that's the work of Lea Mozeso, who's going to defend next week, and there will be a live broadcast, so you will have much more information. We studied smartphone obsolescence, and that was our kind of starting point. So here we looked at what was breaking down, and also the path to extending the lifetime of devices. And so we basically identified three great areas of obsolescence. So often with smartphones, you think that the battery is too old or the screen is broken, but that these are only some of the factors. We also uncover that you have a lot of issues related to grades that you may be aware of, and that's basically where there is the most regulation in the buildup at the moment. But also a lot of changes around storage and how to manage storage and the visibility of storage. And that's like basically also a great source of problems in the everyday experience of smartphones at the moment. And then basically a lot of things that we've called frictions that are related to small bugs or things that are not blocking, but are basically slowing down the phone. And basically when you assemble this with kind of physical problems, you end up with smartphone removal. And so what we did in the study was trying to map. So here you have a path of present. Basically, it's a historical cumulative things that lead you to the point where you say, I cannot use this device anymore, I cannot stand it. And basically, you have a saturated storage, and you have a great problem. It becomes too slow. You have some bugs or the battery that's not holding. Some are really pushing you, others are kind of okay and need you to do things, to basically live with the broken device, and that's fine. But at some point, you start to switch. What we noticed as well in this study, and I won't go into the detail now, are also plenty of strategies that people developed to actually extend the life of the devices by maybe 1 year, maybe 2 years, maybe 6 months. So it can be reinstalling stuff, reconfiguring inputs, for instance, a hardware button that's broken to a touch interface, that kind of thing. Also plenty of things that are related to HCI and to the way you're actually managing and interacting with your devices. And this can help extend the device's life as well. So my main takeaway here is that there's plenty of potential for designing for broken devices and old devices. And that gets people really excited, actually, when we present this work in each of the, I'm browsing a lot of projects quite quickly, but when we go into details and discuss with every people, and actually we see a lot of excitement about these things because it resonates with their everyday experience of the digital. So to wrap up, I'm just going to talk a bit about the way we do this research. A lot of it is participatory. And we develop also tools and practices to do this kind of participatory research. So for instance, for the mini grid project that we worked on with biologists, we actually worked on the way the infrastructure and basically the way the infrastructure would be designed, how the tasks would be distributed. We conducted workshops with them to design the way the networking would work. And that's something that can be done. I don't think it's done very much in the networking community, but there are plenty of, there are some networking people online or here. There are plenty of discussions to have between HCI and the networking community on how you make it, you can actually design the way networks are working so that they become more sober and that people have an influence on the way they work and they better match their needs and practices. And so that's there are plenty of opportunities here. I'm going to skip that one. Another one that's important to us, in HCI, we do a lot of participatory research, but sometimes it's driven by researchers in the sense that we create the workshops, we recruit the people, and then there are some nice people who give us a bit of time and they agree to participate. Over the past, let's say, 5 years, we're in different projects and with different colleagues who are actually really engaged in participatory design, we really work with seeking a balance between participants and researchers so that everybody's gaining from the activity. It's not always easy. And so one of the things we developed for that is Plato, which is a collaborative documentation tool for participatory activities where researchers and participants all together and the different flavors of participants can actually document what's going on in workshop, but also edit what happened after the fact. And everybody has a say. It's a shared infrastructure that, for instance, can be hosted at, for instance, we work with libraries and be hosted in libraries. When we're working in schools, it could be hosted on a school server and not be under our control of researchers. Another thing that we are working hard to do, and that's not really visible in papers, is other forms of communicating our research and giving back to the community. So I passed on this project, but we had also a project with libraries where we created a catalog at the end of the project, synthesizing the ideas we had in the participatory design workshops, the results of the studies we conducted. We even did a bunch of basically business scenarios to see how the research we did could be transformed into public services or created by picked up by private people to create a company out of it. And that's just ended up in a catalog that we distributed to libraries, but that was experience published on this. Related more to the project that we have at hand, we have this, we have a newsletter that we started this summer called Limite Numérique, where we're talking about the projects we are conducting, but also doing a veil, so basically checking what are the news and sharing them with others. And we have probably future collaborators that are reaching out from this newsletter. And that's a way for us to also work with people who are aligned with the stuff that we do. And we are also creating comics from the interviews we conducted so that we have another way of communicating research. And so we are sending the comics back to the people who were interviewed so that they have a kind of summary of the story, also communicating this more broadly to audiences that would not necessarily be interested in reading a kind of paper. I don't know why people don't want to do that. So basically, what are the takeaways from this kind of participatory part? We have a strong stance, not only, but also the most of my colleagues, on saying that there is no wise king, design or engineering king. So I'm working with designers and engineers. And basically, the idea here, you have a lot of figures, especially in France, with engineers or scientists who think that they know better. I think we have let's say the name, let's say Jean Covici, for instance, is the figure of the engineers that knows things, often says stupid things, but with a lot of self assurance, and basically explains to people that they are doing the dumb one. We really are fighting against this sense, and in the research we are doing, we are trying to really work with people from their experiences, from the knowledge they have about what they experience every day, to also rethink with them about how we can change things and redirect them, and so that it's in a way that's actually socially acceptable. To do that, then we create what we call computational alternatives, which are alternatives to the systems we have today. We are not sticking to design concepts or like kind of scenarios. We really build the stuff and try it out. And that's the way we hope we can learn from this kind of alternative computing systems. And hopefully also demonstrating that there are also other futures that are possible. And in the end, basically, we're trying to share this not only with academic publications, but through audience. So that was it for the basically the 3 points I wanted to touch upon today. I've been very long, so I'm just going to switch to the conclusion. So what are some of the takeaways you can maybe remember? One is that HCI has for long been about basically bringing technology to the masses or bringing new tools to the masses and facilitating adoption. When we apply for grants or that kind of thing, that's basically what we say when we are talking about impact in one way or the other. I think we can flip this premise and actually think of the ways we can actually make more sustainable use of technologies today, reduce the use in some areas of society and maybe expand it in others, that's to discuss. But basically really flip some, basically probably reuse some of the techniques we have, but flip the end goal that we have. What I argue, but maybe that's, to be discussed, that's maybe just our point, is that starting from breakdowns in everyday activities is actually a good way to redirect things because you're talking about problems that people are experiencing today. Mundane ones that are not excessively exciting or seems easy to ignore, or that could be fixed by buying a new smartphone or fixing your Wi-Fi or doing that kind of thing. But in practice, it's broken all over. And that's a good starting point to imagine more convivial and several things. And finally, that a good way to do that is to do more action research and participatory research. And that this way, you're really starting from the ground up. And it's also more fun because you're not doing it alone in the lab. Yeah. That's it. Thank you. I hope I wasn't too fast. I was seeing the clock ticking. And that's thank you for your attention. It was the first time I was doing this talk, so thanks for being the ones that are were here to iron it. Feedback is obviously welcome.
Thanks a lot. I think we have the room until 3. So no hurry, a lot of questions we can discuss.
And if you want to run away because you have other things to do, yeah, I won't be offended.
Et pour ceux qui sont à distance, je peux prendre les questions dans le chat ou vous ouvrir au micro pour parler.
And we can do it in French or English depending on what is the story.
So yeah, so there's a, in your talk, there's an implicit assumption that we need machines. They will be there.